Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. We're inspiring conversations for the unafraid. I'm Janice McDonald, founder of the Beacon Agency, author, and global champion for women. Why am I making this show? Because I want to share the inspiring stories of women leaders in business, arts and culture, politics, and more with all of you. Hear how they've chosen to go forward and be bold and make the world a better place, even when it wasn't easy to do. Subscribe now wherever you find podcasts. Hey, everybody, I'm Janice McDonald. Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. Very excited today to welcome Kim Furlong to the studio. She's the CEO of Canada's Venture Capital and Private Equity Association. So we have lots to talk about. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you, Janice.
And welcome, of course, to our many listeners from around the world, including USA, UK, France, Spain, New Zealand, and so many more countries. We want our community to grow, so please tell your friends and follow us on Instagram. Thanks also to our amazing sponsors, 30% Club Canada, ADGA, and BDC. So, Kim, you're the new CEO of Canada's Venture Capital and Private Equity Association. Tell us about the organization and your role. So why were you excited to take this on?
Wow, I had so many reasons why yes, I'm new to the organization. I joined in January, and it's almost amazing that 8 months have gone by already. The organization represents all of private capital in Canada, and that means venture capital and mm-hmm. private equity. Mm-hmm. And both are instrumental in accompanying entrepreneurs in their journey. The venture capital organizations or funds are there very early mm-hmm. when an entrepreneur has an idea and want to see that grow into a company. And private equity, which is a little less known, still has a similar role, but comes into the life of an entrepreneur either mid or late in their life cycle and injects usually both capital and strategy. So when the opportunity came to take on this role, I'm new to the sector. So there was a big learning curve and a new opportunity to network within another segment of the economy, because I'd done other things previously. And I just really felt really passionate that this sector, given the growth that we had seen in the last few years, would be instrumental to Canada's economic development and growth. So here I am, 8 months in and having the time of my life.
And how would you describe your leadership style?
I would say authentic. Mm-hmm. And there's a multitude of reasons for that. But my biggest strength is also my biggest weakness. You know exactly where I stand. I'm straightforward. I tell it as it is. And to me, over the years, learning who I was and speaking my mind, speaking the truth, always, you know, with tact and, you know, making sure no feelings are hurt, but really being who I am, being true to my voice, being authentic, and leading people by enabling them to be who they are. And I'll say surrounding myself with smart people. I'm attracted to intelligent people. I love colorful individuals. And you know, the more authentic they are, the more I feel like we're a good team. So I try to surround myself with those types of individuals.
Smart strategy. Find smart people, right?
Yeah.
And take on the world together. So you're a member organization.
Give us
a sense of how many members are we talking about across the country?
In terms of investing members, about 270. And to give a sense to your audience of who we're talking about here, from the very large pension plans, so Canadian CPPIB, Ontario Teacher, La Caisse de dépôt et placement du Québec, and then OMERS.
The big ones.
Brookfields. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They would be my big members, that the big names that people would recognize. Mm-hmm. And then a large number of venture capital organization I can think about, Innovia, Georgian, were big like growth players, and Real Venture, Relay, anyone in that space would know the people on the venture side. And then on the private equity, NovaCap, Fulcrum Capital, Imperial. So it's
long list.
It's really, if you're a private investor and you want to invest in a company, at any time on the spectrum, my members are who make those investments on their behalf.
So let's talk about women entrepreneurs and funding. So as you know, I've done considerable amount of research on women entrepreneurs. I'm in the midst actually of our third national study, this time with a focus looking at the challenges and opportunities for women in export. So getting this right, of course, is so important, and it's and so is funding. So what do you want women entrepreneurs to know when they think about funding and also when they think about the opportunities that exist under that big umbrella of your organization?
Well, any entrepreneur out there who's looking for financing will know that it's not easy. And the stats for women founders, women entrepreneurs, are abysmal.
Yes. So depressing.
Yeah. 64%, I believe, of all dollars that are invested by men in men. A small portion of, I believe, 11% of partners in VC firms are women. Mm-hmm.
Which I didn't even think it was that high.
Yeah. And partner is a writ large term here. Like not, it's a bit generous. So there's a lot of work to be done. And that question has been put to me a number of times in the last 8 months. And I always joke that the first step was putting a woman at the head of the organization in terms of diversity.
And I would jump in and say, and signaling change.
Very much. This is a boys' club. Mm-hmm. This has been, and it's been a small sector that is growing. And with that growth and with the outside pressure, and I'll say this, Janice, a lot of the change is coming from pressure that are from outside of the industry. The investors are looking for diversity. The investors are looking for teams that are not a number of men that all look the same. Mm-hmm. So, and they want different perspective coming at a table and having a conversation that brings richness and diverse views, which studies show, and you've done your homework, which show that when you have that diversity, and I'd be remiss not to say the term inclusion, because diversity without the inclusion doesn't work. But when you have those two factors present, you have much higher returns.
Yes. I mean, there's so much research backing this up. Smart companies know that that's the answer.
Yes.
Right? They do. And so this is an exciting time. And as you mentioned, is signaling real change, having you at the helm. So I think this is an important time for Canada too.
Very much so. And within my first few months, we released a diversity and inclusion, the first benchmark study that CVC had ever produced. And the reception was very good, even though the results were not. But I think that also signals that we were ready to measure ourselves and to think about how do we equip our members with the tools and a new way of thinking and approaching when they're recruiting, as they build their teams. And for me, the work is just beginning. And it's exciting. And it's also daunting because you'll know how hard it is to move the marker. But I've never shied away from a challenge. So this one, you know, is up ahead.
And we need you. We need you making sure that you actually overcome and that your members see the value. But again, the business case is strong.
Very much so.
Yeah. So fearless. Let's talk about that. So fearless by definition is being unafraid or at least being bold. So what's the last thing you've done to scare yourself? Of course, taking on your CEO role, tell us about that. But, you know, when you're thinking about whether it's that or something else, how do you muster the courage? Like, is there something that, you know, do you have a mantra or is there a song you sing or, you know, a chant you do? Like, how, first of all, how do you even, you know, kind of say, yes, I'm going to do it?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. What's the last scary or bold thing I did? Taking this job for someone who had no background in private capital was, most people would have self-selected out, and I decided to self-select in because I thought and I knew that I had the attributes to lead this organization. The last really scary thing I did was there's a large conference that took place in Toronto a few months ago called Collision.
Yes, of course.
So big global tech conference. Choosing Toronto for 3 years in a row to host and bring the world and really putting Canada at the forefront of the opportunities for tech companies to grow and the talent and the energy that Canada is putting towards its innovation and tech industry. I got an invitation to be one of the judge for the semifinal pitch competition, to which I
thought, I said to my staff,
should I do this? They're like, yes, it's going to be exciting. You should do it. I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. This is great visibility. And I showed up at the conference. I'd been there for the first few days. And as I was getting mic'd up and ready to go, I suddenly realized that a lot of the people that were on the stage with me were some of my members, like some very serious investors and then I had a moment
in season
two, these guys have been doing this for a year. And I'm thinking, I've never invested in anyone. I have to go on the stage and then talk about these companies. And those are those moments where you think, oh, I may have like overstepped on this one. So you kind of shake it off and, you know, you're already mic'd up, so you're not going anywhere.
No running away.
And I did great. Like I had my own views about, you know, the pitch and gave what I thought was positive and, you know, constructive criticism. And I did a prediction and two of my three companies came out ahead. So I walked away thinking, you know what? This is just another example. Even though it's a little scary and you think it's over your head, you just have to, you know, shake it off and keep going.
I think you just made the business case for diversity and inclusion right there.
There you go.
Right? Different perspective.
Yeah.
Different way of looking at the world. And that's adding true value to not only that conversation, but if you look at the outcomes, that's really powerful.
And I guess in terms of mantra, I talk to myself all the time when, you know, you have to make big decisions or throughout my career with big jobs. And I think the expression just do it comes to mind and really asking myself, what's the worst that can happen? You know, and we can talk about failure because I love failure. But what's the worst that can happen? Looking at the guys around you and thinking, are they going to do any better? And really quickly coming to the realization that no, and knowing that there's always someone there to ask for help. And being women is wonderful because your network, and every woman who's listening right now knows who that network is, like those five or six girls that you can call at any point that will dig into their own network and kind of show up for you.
Yes.
So I always think, if I don't know, someone else will, and no one's going to let me fail.
Except I will say, and this is the real gem of what you've just shared, you have to be willing to ask your network for the help.
Oh,
and sometimes there's a reluctance. Sometimes women feel like, oh, I don't want to ask. But that's the whole point. What's the point of having this amazing network if you don't ask for the help you need?
I actually think you have to state it early. Like as you're thinking about an opportunity or if you're debating if you should do something, you have to say to your network, both men and women, and I have a lot of men that I turn to say, if I do this and I need help along the way, can I count on you? And everyone will say yes.
That's a great way of framing it too, because you build in your support. They're at the ready for you.
Yeah.
That's really positive. I love that. What's something that you wish you knew earlier in your career?
Wow. Not waiting for a signal or an approbation or someone to tell you to go for it.
Mm.
Like in my younger self, like I remember, you know, wanting things, wanting to lead, but thinking probably not me, or what if I fail? Like how will people perceive me? And it took me a while to figure out that failure is just information and opportunity. You learn from it, you keep going, and it always appears bigger.
Like the threat of failure can hang over you.
Yes,
yeah.
It's just, you always think it's going to be worse to fail. And when you do.
And we all do.
Yes.
And we all do.
and thank God we do, because if we didn't, we wouldn't learn. Mm-hmm. Like, when's the last thing you got from success? Mm-hmm. There's no lessons mm-hmm. in success. Mm-hmm. There's pride, there's mm-hmm. joy, there's a lot of things that come from success, but you certainly don't grow and learn from it. So every failure, you'll have to celebrate, you know, take the moment to, you know, shed a tear or like bow your head. But after that, just shake it off. And okay, next time when you know better, you do better.
Yeah. I guess the thing is, provided you're actually taking the time to learn from the failure.
Yes.
Right. Actually uncover the lesson in there.
Yeah. And actually being very aware of that failure is not a reflection of who you are, but just a moment or an incident that, you know, you could put aside, put behind, and keep going.
Doesn't have to define you.
It doesn't.
So you talked about having a strong network. So what's kind of your approach to networking? How do you create these amazing relationships that you have and that you turn to? Do you have a strategy, or is it just always come naturally to you? And if so, what's some advice for people that may feel like, you know, because sometimes the idea of like, oh, I have to go to a networking event and hand out 500 business cards.
Yeah.
You know, people say, how's that helping? So what's Kim's approach?
Well, I'll start by saying that I've been groomed to network from a very young age. I grew up in a very rural area of Quebec on the Gaspé Coast, the Gaspé Peninsula. And you couldn't go anywhere. There was no public transit unless you needed a car to get to things. And I would often ask my parents, can I go to the dance or can I go to this event? And my dad would always say, someone's going. Pick up the phone, work the phone book. If you can find someone to take you there and come back, then you can go. And those were the early days of networking, because you had to kind of get over the fact that you had to ask.
Right.
And, you know, getting over that shyness, I think, was the early lesson in networking and hustling.
And finding your voice, too.
Yeah, and the shyness. But I'll say this about a big reception, because most people would think of me, like my network and friends, as someone who's very outgoing. And I do get a lot of energy from people. And once I get going, and I'm pretty chatty, but I find it very daunting. So for anyone who knows me or has interacted with me, who thinks like Kim, like she thinks this is great, like before you go into the room, especially if you don't know anyone, if you're at an international conference, you're there, you're going in and you just, and I often kind of like take a deep breath and think, okay, half this room does not know anyone either. And it's just that first person that you go and introduce yourself to. It's scary. It makes you uncomfortable. Everyone likes to talk and everyone likes to tell their stories. So you just go and ask a few, you know, simple questions. And after a while, hopefully you'll see a familiar face in the room. And then, you know, by the end of the night, you've amassed another number of people that, you know, you've connected with. But for anyone that thinks that everyone is natural at this, even the people that are outgoing, and I don't know if you'd agree, Janice, but it's not easy to cold call in a reception and when you don't know anyone.
I think I love what you said, this idea of framing it so that it becomes less daunting. So right away saying, well, half the people here don't know anybody.
Yeah.
So you kind of look around for friendly faces, you know, that seem receptive to conversation. That's a great strategy.
When I came to Ottawa, I was here to do a master's degree and then ended up working in government. And when I made the switch to politics, there was a lot of receptions. And I wasn't one who had grew up in the party, so I didn't know anyone. And I always thought, if I know where the bathrooms are and I need a moment, you know, if I know where the bathrooms are, I'm fine. So I'd always walk in, spot where the bathrooms are, you know, take a moment, shake it off and go back in. And that was a good trick in the early days.
That's a simple strategy, but very effective, because it can. And then you can often have a great conversation.
Yes.
We women tend to gather and have conversations everywhere. So I love that. So you talked about growing up in Gaspé and that it's rural and remote. take us back to the 10-year-old Kim. So we know what you did to go to dances, but what was that 10-year-old girl like?
She was interesting. She was a much younger version of who I am now. I feel like I'm older, but very much that same girl. I grew up in a family of entrepreneurs. My parents had restaurants, and I started working when I was about 9.
I was going to say, you know how to work hard. If there's a restaurant in the family, for sure.
We worked really hard. We worked long hours, 16-hour shifts, 7 days a week. Not when I was 9, but like when I was putting myself through school. And I remember thinking that only working 8 hours was kind of a vacation.
Are long days, and on your feet and on the go.
On the feet, on the go, but we worked as a family, my parents, my brother and I. Like, there was nowhere else you had to be, or there were other places you could be, but because you were part of this team, this family that were, and my parents, that's what they did to earn a living. And it was only in the summer, like the restaurant shut down in the winter because it was a very seasonal place.
That makes sense.
We all went really hard and worked hard at making it a success. And even thinking about failure, like growing up in a family of entrepreneurs, like we saw the ups and downs, you know, bankruptcies and just making it work.
Yes.
Just making it work and seeing our parents lead by example and working hard. And so it made failure less daunting when you've gone through that, like at a young age, like visualize it and experience it as a family member. But I have wanted to lead from at that age. I was 9 or 10. I was too scared to do it. And even through high school, like didn't often put myself forward, but I still wanted to do it. It took a while to get a stride and think, okay, I can do this. But I'll say this for sure. The external facing experiences of being a waitress, of working in bars, of, you know, just having to speak to people on a regular basis was such a formative part of my life and who I am. I often joke that I got a job in government working for the G8 summit by telling them that I could handle media because I could handle grumpy tourists when it was raining. And my friends would laugh. But I go back to the authenticity, like straight. No, this is how I think I can do this. And I got the job. So,
and real lessons learned.
Yeah.
Because they are transferable skills.
Yeah. When you have like a member of the media haunting you and like being really rude to you on the phone, it's equivalent to someone being rude to you in a restaurant and how tactful you're going to be in responding to them and not losing your cool. And I thought that was a very transferable skill. Most people probably would have skipped that answer. But it makes me laugh thinking back on those days.
But very practical things that you learned.
Yes.
That stay with you. But and also the power of hard work and the pride of a family business.
Yeah. No, it's there's nothing I've done since that's been as physically grueling as the work I did. And we'd have a break in the afternoon and we'd have to go back around 3:30, 4 o'clock. And I lived by the ocean. And that's at the time where the wind dies. And everything becomes calm. And it's like that perfect late afternoon calmness. And there was often like a heaviness of having to go back to the restaurant and do another shift. And years later, like I'm an avid golfer and I would golf often. And that would be the time on the golf course, like 20 years would have passed. And I would still have a moment of gratitude for being able to golf.
That's beautiful. Yeah. No second shift.
Yeah. No second shift.
That's amazing. So what about mentors and champions? Have they been important in your career?
There's definitely been people that I've turned to for advice and that I've admired and tried to emulate in terms of their leadership style.
What would be an example? What would be a leadership style that you want to emulate?
Just inclusive. I had a boss for a number of years who really treated his team as his advisory board, and he would always have the final say, but I didn't realize until I became a boss myself how much work it takes to be inclusive and to schedule the meeting and to hear everyone out and to debate the ideas. And to me, I've always felt that no one is important. Everyone has a role to play. even when I worked for a big multinational company, like the CEO to me was just someone with different skills who different had a different function. Role to play yeah. in the mm-hmm. success of the company. And I believe that my salary was not commensurate to his, but my importance in the success of the company was as equal as his. And that could be, you know, people could roll their eyes at that. But that belief that no one is important, I think has translated in my leadership style in that my entire team is important. From mm-hmm. the person who runs my calendar to the person who runs our business development, everyone has a role to play. And I'll unload the dishwasher. It's no one else. You know, I don't feel like there's a hierarchy in that. So that leadership style has played a role in terms of like forming me. Mm-hmm.
What about the mentors and champions? Have you had specific or has it been more?
Elsa Trunick, who mm-hmm. ran Mars, has not been like a former mentor of mine, but I've kept close to her and she's always been graceful enough to give me some time and make time for me. And I remember her saying years ago over a dinner that she had agreed to do with me, life is not a race. And it resonated so strongly at the time because I was kind of thinking, okay, I need to do a change. I need to do this. What am I going to do next? And it was just so reassuring and kind of taking a step back and thinking, okay, you know, it's not a race. You know, how do I do this very well? How do I prepare for the next step? How do I cross all the T's and dot all the I's before I'm ready to move on to something else? And she's someone that I keep close to me. But I've never had a formal mentoring where you would meet regularly with people. There's also younger women around me that I've spotted and I try to give some time and they've reached out to me once in a while to kind of check the pulse on a decision that they've tried to make. And to me, anyone who calls within my network will get some of my time. Someone years ago said to me, the best advice out there, if you're looking for a job or you're looking for help, is be very specific. Don't ask someone, can you find me a job? Ask someone, can you introduce me to this or that person in a company? And I took that to heart as the years went by, like being very aware of people's time and how busy they are. And if you ask something very crisp and concise, oftentimes they'll deliver for you.
And because they know exactly what you want.
Yes.
Those kind of big asks that you don't know what's coming at the end of it
yes.
can be daunting.
Yeah. And mentorship should not be work. It should, right. The mentor should get something out of it because they feel the energy that you bring to the conversation. And there's certain like women that are more experienced than me and a bit older that I have coffees and breakfasts with. And I often walk away feeling it was a mutually pleasant half hour, hour where, you know, they're talking about what they're doing, you know, often retired and on boards and I'm, you know, giving my two cents, especially some of them have government affairs challenges. And it has to be a two-way street. And I always say, like, ask smart questions and you know, don't
come
take
prepared.
Too much. Yeah, come prepared. Don't ask, mm-hmm. don't take too much time either.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly don't go see a mentor if you've got nothing going on, just a chat.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like what you're advising is to have a lot of intention around it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because this is not networking.
Right.
This is person that's helping you navigate.
Yes. In a very specific way and with a finite amount of time.
That's right.
Absolutely. So competitive sports, were those part of your early days? Did you have time to be active in that way? Or I mean, because you, when you're working, the kind of hours you were.
Yeah, I was only working in the summer. So yeah, sports have always been a big part of my life. Basketball in high school, hockey, badminton, and then really in university. In university, I joined the triathlon team when I was at McGill, competed for a few years. And I still am an avid cyclist. I'm competing in a few weeks in the Grand Fondo in the Prince Edward County 100K, which I have not ridden 100K this summer. So that's going to be a bit scary, something bold.
That's a little fearless right there.
Yeah, a little fearless right there. But so sports is, I've always been a personal competitor. I compete against myself. put my own yardsticks and try mm-hmm. to reach them. But I also think it clears your mind mm-hmm. with the years. And I have a young family and I have a busy work. It's where you kind of get your energy and you feel it. Like when you're traveling and like things get in the way and you don't exercise on a regular basis, I feel like your clarity of mind also takes a toll. So it's very important to me. And I think doing it from a young age, it's just part of me.
Mm-hmm. And I would add, from my experience, I see it as part of my mental toughness.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. It really shapes your mind. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're out for a run and it's not going well, the decision to turn around or to keep going and mm-hmm. just powering through can be easily translated into having a challenge at work and deciding, you know, are you quitting? Or are you going through? And doing that on a regular basis, physically, will help you power through the tough stuff going through your life.
So, final question. What's your dream, Kim, for Canada?
Wow. I think Canada needs to be bold. I really, like, in the work I'm doing right now, Canada is having a moment. We are producing more tech job than the Valley, Boston, and in New York combined. Our numbers are coming out for the second quarter or the second half of this year. 2 $1 billion quarters back to back in VC. Lots of dollars available. Companies that are not only being started here, but growing here. But all of that could change in a minute if international conditions shifted, if the U.S. Added different leadership, if immigration rules for skilled workers were to change in the U.S. And I just think it would be fabulous if we had an opportunity to, and I think back on the Own the Podium campaign during the Vancouver Olympics, and for Canada to own the podium at every chance possible, and that it became part of our DNA, and that failure would not be seen as a reason to retreat. And I've seen in the past where big Canadian companies have failed and Canadians have said, oh, well, you know, that was expected, or almost bowing their head, like, you know, of course, this was going to be the course of the fate of this company. And to shake that off and say, no, no, no. Failure is just the opportunity of that entrepreneur to go back and create something new, for the policies that the government put in place to support that, for Canadian to celebrate when someone is successful, to see that growth. And I'll add something that is, you know, sometimes forgotten when we think about growth in business, but that inclusivity and diversity agenda needs to be present. So the growth cannot come at the expense. I don't want Canada to be the United States. I want us to have a very strong social fabric. I want people that come here to feel like it's a great place to live. And yet I want us to, and it's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to have a very strong economic agenda and a very strong social agenda. But if anyone can do it, it's us.
I'm so moved by that beautiful vision for Canada. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today, Kim. I've been speaking with Kim Furlong. She's the CEO of Canada's Venture Capital and Private Equity Association. She is going to be cycling 100 kilometers in the next little bit and taking on the leadership in a very big and dramatic way of her association. So fabulous having you on the show today, Kim. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Janice.
Thanks for listening. We want our community to grow. Tell your friends, follow us on Instagram, and sign up for our newsletter at fearlesswomenpodcast.com to get the early scoop. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite app. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating. I'm Janice McDonald. Stay fearless. Thank you to the 30% Club Canada for your support of the Fearless Women Podcast. The 30% Club believes that gender balance on boards and in senior management not only encourages better leadership and governance, but diversity further contributes to better all-around board performance and ultimately increased corporate performance for both companies and their shareholders. Want to learn more? Visit their website, 30%club.org, and select the Canada chapter to find out about membership, supporters, and key resources. Thank you to BDC, the bank devoted exclusively to entrepreneurs, for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. We love smart companies that want to amplify women's voices. For more information, go to bdc.ca/women.